From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Lots of big news in the world of vaccine development this week. The biggest, a coronavirus vaccine is entering phase 3 clinical trials. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, he talked with reporters yesterday about it. And if you glanced at the headlines that popped up out of that conference call, you might think that Fauci said a COVID vaccine could be here by mid to late fall. Well, that's not exactly what he said, nor did Fauci make any kind of concrete guarantee. But given all the news around vaccines this week and the many questions that follow those headlines, we thought today is a good time to put those questions to scientists and experts, to get past the tweets and past the sound bites and the headlines, and really understand what's happening now with potential COVID vaccines. So this hour on Point, understanding phase 3 trials and what could come next. And we'll start with Caroline Chen. She's a reporter covering healthcare and the coronavirus pandemic for ProPublica. She joins us from New York. Caroline, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so I believe it was just yesterday, Dr. Fauci had this conference call with reporters talking about the phase 3 trial for that Moderna vaccine. And I saw a whole bunch of headlines saying, you know, we might have something by fall, by November. What exactly did Dr. Fauci say?
So I think what is really exciting about the Moderna trial that we have is that it's moved into the phase 3 trial right now, which is the last step of clinical trials. And the phase 3 trial somebody said to me, I love this phrase. This is from Paul Offit. He said, you know, if the proof is in the pudding is the phase 3 trial. So Moderna has finally moved into this phase, which we've been waiting for. But, you know, when Fauci says that, you know, we could have this data, you know, the phase 3 trial data could come by fall, that means we could have an answer to whether or not Moderna's vaccine works by sometime in, you know, mid to late fall. So that's what he's saying. You know, we could have an answer to this phase 3 trial by sometime this fall. However, phase 3 trials aren't designed so that there is an end date, which is marked in the sand. You know, we don't put them on a schedule. They depend on how many people are getting sick. And we can talk about this trial design. So it's a bit of an estimate. And I think that's really important for people to understand that we don't have a calendar date, which we can all mark and say, like, this is going to be the golden date.
Right. So that's really important to note, because when Fauci says that we could have something by mid to late fall, just to emphasize what you're saying, he's saying that we could have results from this trial, from the 30,000 people or so who are part of this phase 3 trial. Results don't necessarily mean successful results, nor do they mean FDA approval, right?
Yes. So there are many possible scenarios. So let's talk about best case scenario, because I want to be optimistic here. So let's say, you know, let's say mid to late fall, the trial runs really well. And let me be clear here. Trial runs really well means that a lot of people continue to be infected. And we can talk about how a phase 3 trial runs and what is necessary for it to run. But for us to have results sooner means that people continue to get infected from now until mid-fall. So let's say mid-fall, we have results. The results are really clear. You know, black and white, the vaccine works. So then the FDA has to look at the data and say, not only is it effective, but is it clearly safe? There are no safety issues. We have no concerns whatsoever. So let's say best case scenario, it is clearly safe. There are no questions about that. It's clearly effective. 100% home run. So then the FDA approves it. And then there's not going to be an expectation that there's going to immediately be enough either for the U.S. or for the whole world. Moderna is already starting to make vaccine at scale, even while the trial is running. So there will be, you know, doses in the millions available, but that's not going to be enough for everyone. So that's the best case scenario. But there could be a case where the data comes out and it looks good, but there are some questions about it. Or, you know, there's some discussion and the FDA, because it is the regulator, has the ability to ask for more data from the company and wants some time to review it more carefully. And so the FDA is the gatekeeper here, and we want the FDA to be in this position of being the gatekeeper to then make the decision. So, you know, mid to late fall as the date of is, you know, the earliest at which we will get the results. And as you say, there are then steps to come.
Well, we'll talk a little bit later, Caroline, about the pressures the FDA might be under in terms of providing approval when the trial is completed, if it's successful. But sort of the confusion around what Fauci said yesterday and the headline-grabbing nature of it, because I think we're all grasping for some good news, right? So it's easy to walk away from your Twitter feed thinking, or your Facebook feed thinking, wow, Dr. Anthony Fauci says we could have a vaccine by November. But so I think he was rather sensitive to that as the hours ticked by yesterday, because last night on CNN, Dr. Fauci came on CNN, spoke with Wolf Blitzer and clarified some of those earlier comments. Here's what he said.
You know, this vaccine was developed here at the National Institutes of Health in collaboration with the Moderna company. We have a vaccine trial network set up to conduct the trial. So the idea about getting this off the ground and getting the trial conducted, you can almost guarantee that is going to happen, Wolf. I can't guarantee you the success of the vaccine because only a clinical trial will determine that. But I can virtually guarantee you that this has got off to a good start and we will get this trial completed.
Dr. Anthony Fauci on CNN last night. Caroline, so I would like to understand a little bit better how is the trial design defining what success would be, okay? Because I'm seeing here also that Dr. Fauci has said that the goal of the vaccine would be to reduce the risk of infection, of coronavirus infection, by 60%. I mean, for the average person, what does that actually mean?
Yeah, I think this is so important for us to start to get our heads around, for the public to start thinking about, just to set expectations. So I think everybody can kind of grasp this idea. And what I like to tell people to think about is, you know, we know that there are some vaccines that are incredibly effective. So you think about the MMR vaccine, you know, measles, mumps, rubella, that is extremely effective vaccine. You get the two doses that are recommended. And when you do the two doses, those are about 97% effective at just absolutely preventing infection at all in the first place. But, you know, as lay people can understand and grasp, you know, year to year, the flu shot's effectiveness varies. And that actually has to do with the fact that the seasonal flu shifts a lot year to year, and that scientists have to be predicting year to year. So they actually have a very difficult job. So the question that none of us know the answer to at this point is, where is the coronavirus vaccine going to fall in terms of its effectiveness? You know, and when a vaccine is 100% or really close to 100% effective, the term that scientists use is that it gives what they call sterilizing immunity. So like, how close are we going to get to sterilizing immunity, 100% effectiveness? But I think what's really important for the public to understand is that we don't need 100% effective vaccine for us to make a huge difference in this pandemic. Like, it can be good enough to have a vaccine that helps reduce the effects of COVID that helps to prevent severe illness by a big amount. So just think about this. Like, if, you know, we all know that we're really concerned about the elderly. You know, if you have a grandparent, I'm sure you've been really worried about your grandparent getting sick or hospitalized. So if you had a vaccine that, say, was extremely effective at reducing the effects of the coronavirus so that even if your grandparent got sick, you know, the chance of them getting hospitalized was reduced by 70 or 80%. Like, you would want that vaccine, right? Like, that would be a great vaccine. So this is what they're talking about when they talk about measuring the effect of it at reducing severe illness. So this is what the trials are set up to measure. So when vaccine manufacturers talk about effective, there are two common definitions. One is preventing people from getting sick. So this is, we're talking about like the severity of the illness. And two is preventing people from getting infected at all. And both of these measures are things that they track in the process of running a phase three trial.
Right. So that's absolutely fascinating, you know, and we're going to dig into more about how this might be working in the body a little bit later in the show. But Carolyn, I want to circle back to one thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is still remarkable. I mean, this is still history making. Whether or not this trial, quote unquote, succeeds, we've only known about the novel coronavirus for, I'm losing count now, around nine months, possibly
not
a little
even.
Longer than that. Not even, right? And we're
yeah.
at a phase three trial for a vaccine. Can you just spend a minute just reminding us how remarkable that is?
Oh, it is incredible. And, you know, as a health reporter watching this get underway, it is just amazing to me. Like, truly, I am amazed. So to give a little bit of context here, on average, vaccine development takes years, like typically, you know, 7 to 10 years from development, in the lab all the way to approval. So this is happening truly at a remarkable speed. And I want to address, I hear a lot of people who say to me, you know, concerned friends who say, you know, when I hear that this is going to be the fastest vaccine ever developed, that doesn't make me feel good. It makes me nervous that they're going to cut corners.
Well, we'll talk more about safety and the development of a coronavirus vaccine when we come back. We're talking with experts and we'll hear from researchers as well in a second about where we are in the development of a vaccine for the novel coronavirus. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are asking questions and getting answers to where we are in the development of a potential vaccine for the novel coronavirus. Caroline Chen joins us. She's a reporter for ProPublica covering healthcare and the pandemic as well. And Caroline, before the break, you were just getting to your answer to the question of, is this high-speed vaccine development process going to lead to a safe vaccine and the concerns around that? And I just wanted to let you finish your thought there.
Yeah, I think the one thing that I just wanted people to know is that the biggest way that speed is happening right now is that manufacturers are actually starting to what they call manufacture at risk. And the risk that is happening there is actually not a risk to anybody's body or health or safety. It's a financial risk where manufacturers are starting to make a lot of vaccines, millions of doses of vaccine, even before they know the results of their phase three trial. So that usually never happens. And that's a part where they're compressing a lot of time. So Moderna is making millions of of doses of vaccine while their phase three trial is already happening. And normally a manufacturer would never do that because that's not like good business sense, right? They would only make just enough vaccine for their trial. And then if it was successful, then they would like go and make it at scale. So what they're doing right now is they're making millions of doses. And if their phase three trial is not successful, they're just going to have to throw it all away. But if it is successful, then they'll have millions of doses ready to go. So that's sort of the major way that time is being compressed. And it's pretty remarkable that so many companies are doing that.
Interesting. Well, that leads me to a whole bunch of other follow-up questions of what might happen around the time where they need FDA approval. But we'll come back to that in a couple of minutes, Caroline, because I want to bring into the conversation now Florian Kramer. Florian's a professor of microbiology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. His research focuses on immunology, infectious disease, and vaccine development. Professor Kramer, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. How is it going?
I guess pretty well, all things considered. It's interesting news here that we're in the, you know, this phase three trial of Moderna and the NIH's potential COVID vaccine here. But I wanted to sort of dive into the human body a little bit with you, Professor, and ask you, what do we know now about what immunity to the novel coronavirus would look like? Because, for example, there are many questions about for people who have had it and they have antibodies in their system. There's been some news reports recently that came out that said maybe that antibody immunity fades away rather quickly. So can you help us understand what do we know about that at this point in time?
Yeah, of course. We know already a lot of things. What we see is the immune response to natural infections seems to be a robust, normal immune response. We see antibodies that go up to very high levels initially and then slowly decline. And it is to be expected that they decline a little bit and then the decline flattens out and they would stay around for some time. That's what you normally see after a viral infection. We see the formation or the induction of T cells, which are important for actually getting a good antibody response, CD4 T cells, but also CD8 T cells, which clear infected cells. So what we see right now looks pretty normal for a viral infection. What we also see, and this is typical for respiratory tract infections, we also see mucosal immunity, so antibodies that show up in your upper respiratory tract or in your saliva. And so what we don't know yet is how long and how high are these immune responses are going to be and to stay, and how much of an immune response do you actually need in order to be protected? And that's the big question.
That's the question that's just leaping to the top of mind, right? Because everybody wants to know, do you have sort of a durable immunity to SARS-CoV-2 once you've had it? And we still don't know if that's true or not. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than that because durable immunity can come through different mechanisms, right? One could be antibodies that are present in your serum, that you can easily measure. But there's also other types of immune cells, memory B cells, for example, which actually don't make antibody, but they could start to make antibody very quickly if you get exposed to the virus again. And specifically for a virus like SARS coronavirus 2 that has a relatively long incubation time, those cells could make a huge difference. So it's a relatively complex situation, but again, it looks like a normal immune response to a respiratory virus.
Interesting. Caroline, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, Dr. Kramer, it's nice to be on the show with you. It's good to hear you. I think the part that I think people get really scared about, and I was wondering if you could comment on, is I think when they see news reports that say, oh, like antibodies might be declining, they get scared that means that a vaccine won't work. What do you think? You're saying that this looks like a normal response to a viral infection. Can you talk about maybe the role of T cells here, memory T cells? Do you think that from everything you've seen so far, How effective would a vaccine be? And, you know, how do other parts of the immune system, you know, like T cells, come into play with a vaccine?
I think we need to revisit how an immune response looks like, right? So if you get infected, there's a subset of B cells that are called plasmablasts that react very quickly, make a lot of antibodies, and then they just die. And so the huge amounts of antibodies that you get initially start to decline. But then another type of B cell, long-lived plasma cells that migrate to your bone marrow, take over, and they are usually the cells that produce stable antibody levels in your serum. And then you have the memory B cells. And then in addition to that, you have T cells that could also come in. With T cells, it's a little bit complicated because there are tissue resident memory T cells that are very helpful to clear virus from respiratory infections. There are other types of memory T cells. So it's really a combination. But most of the vaccines that we see right now are really geared towards inducing high levels of antibodies. And these antibodies, and we have seen that from phase two trials from Moderna, from Pfizer, but also from AstraZeneca, for example, they can neutralize the virus. And typically, we see these neutralizing antibodies correlating with protection. Again, we have to show this now for SARS coronavirus 2, but for many other virus infections, those neutralizing antibody levels are what actually correlates with how well you are protected.
Mm-hmm. So can I just follow up on that then? Because if they are showing, if these vaccine trials are showing that they can neutralize the virus, that seems rather important for something like COVID because of the danger of, as we know, of asymptomatic carriers transmitting the disease. So is that a fair statement to make that? The virus would be neutralized in asymptomatic carriers as well, and that's important?
So that's where it's getting tricky, right? Typically, if you have vaccines that are injected intramuscularly or intradermally, they don't induce mucosal antibodies, so antibodies that sit in your upper respiratory tract. They make antibodies that protect your lung very well. So I guess the question is if these vaccines are going to protect from asymptomatic or upper respiratory tract infection, and that needs to be seen. They are very likely going to protect from severe infections of the lung.
Okay. Well, I just want to let folks know that if you have a question about where we are in the development process of a COVID vaccine, hop over to Twitter or Facebook and find us at On Point Radio and send us your question that way. You know, Caroline and Florian, we're going to come back repeatedly, I think, to questions around safety in this remarkable development process here, because, for example, we have this coming in from Facebook, where Don Kloss is saying, people with COVID sometimes appear to get better, then there's the cytokine storm, which contributes to death. Children sometimes get multisystem inflammatory syndrome after recovering. So Don has a couple of worries. One, the conditions in children and adults can be a, quote, allergic reaction. Could they be to COVID antibodies? And if so, the vaccines we're counting on might turn out to be dangerous to a significant proportion of the population. Is there a chance the vaccine could be dangerous in this way? Florian Kramer, your response to that?
I think that's why we are doing phase three trials. So far, the safety profiles of these vaccines in phase two looked pretty good. There was reactogenicity. There was, in some cases, headaches or, you know, injection site pain. But this needs to be evaluated now in a larger part of the population. And most of these phase three trials are going to be in people 18 to, I've just seen the Pfizer press release, 18 to 85. I'm not sure how much evaluation in children is planned for these first phase three trials. Usually you would do a dose escalation or de-escalation study, age de-escalation study. And this is a safe way to find out if there are complications. You never know with vaccines. You know, there might be problems that you don't see if you test in 100 or 200 people, but then you might find out when you test in 10,000 or 30,000 people. And again, this is why we're doing phase three trials.
Mm. Yeah, just to answer the question about, well, first of all, I want to say I totally agree with everything that Professor Kramer just said, which is why the phase three trials are so important to do, which is you might see a very promising immune signal in the phase two trials, which are in hundreds of people, and it looks pretty safe in them. But that's why you need to do the tens of thousands of people phase three trial to continue to prove out the safety profile. And that's what they are doing right now. But even beyond that, the FDA continues to track post-market because even when you have done a phase three trial in, say, 30,000 people and you have 30,000 people's worth of data, 30,000 people is not the same as 30 million people, right? So there could be a super, super, super rare side effect. And that is what post-marketing tracking is really important for. And the FDA does do that. So, you know, tracking a vaccine safety profile is sort of an ongoing, even beyond trial process. To answer the question about children, I did ask a bunch of the manufacturers about this, whether or not they'd be testing in children, whether or not they'd be approving it in children first. And the answer, at least from Moderna, was that there wouldn't be people under 18 in this initial phase three trial, which means that they wouldn't, you know, at least in the first approval, if it wasn't tested in children, it wouldn't be approved first for children. So it wouldn't be available initially for under 18s, but they do plan to eventually study it in children. And that's important that you don't, you know, give it willy-nilly to, you know, children if it hasn't been studied in them. That's the same thing that the NIH's Dr. Mascola said to me, which is that it's important to study it in children before, you know, making it available to them. But at this point in time, we know that the big concern with COVID-19 is for the elderly, which is why they are specifically making sure to recruit and test the vaccine in people over the age of 55 first. Uh-huh. So they're sort of trying to bring it to the people who are most at risk. And then at this point in time, the most acute need isn't in children. So they'll bring it to them later, but they are going to make sure that it is safe for under 18s before releasing the vaccine for them.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because, you know, in the event that the vaccine does get approved, it's likely that, you know, the people who are most at risk ought to be the first in line for it. But are they the ones who are part of this trial? So it's good to hear at least the answer is partially yes to that. Now, Professor Kramer, look, we've got an interesting question that's come in, and it's one that's also popped into my mind because the question is about how are we going to know if this vaccine or any vaccine for COVID would confer long-term protection against the virus? For example, Del D'Souza says, aren't long-term studies required for vaccine development? Lab mice have a lifespan of more than 1 year, so is it possible to see if there's just a short-term immune response and quantify? Are researchers just relying on the efficacy of previous vaccines or cell cultures? So, Professor Kramer, what do you think about that?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and that's actually easy to answer. So you cannot extrapolate these things from lab mice or even other animal models. You have to look at that in humans. And this is real-time data, right? And as we just heard, there is post-marketing studies called phase four studies that also help to, you know, track immunity. And it could well be that these vaccines only give protection for some time, maybe 2 or 3 years. And it might be that you have to get revaccinated after that point in time. And post-marketing studies will actually show that. That wouldn't be a big deal because you need to get booster doses for other vaccines, tetanus, for example, every now and then as well. So that wouldn't be a deal breaker. That's something that needs to be monitored and evaluated. And there could well be differences between vaccine candidates in terms of how long-lived the protection is. But it's a good question, and this needs to be assessed.
Well, we've only got you for about another minute or so, Professor Kramer. So let me ask you, what do you think are still, in your mind, the top important questions that you'd like to see answered prior to the approval of any future COVID vaccine?
Well, there's basically just two questions that need to be answered, right? The first one is, does the vaccine work? Is it efficacious? And if it is efficacious, how well does it work? And the second question is it going to be safe in phase three trials? Those are the two questions that need to be answered. And if you have answers for those, or if the FDA has answers for those, they can move forward and license the vaccine, or basically send more questions, right? I don't think there's much more than we need to know.
Okay. Wait, well, we are talking this hour about where we are in terms of the development of a potential vaccine for the coronavirus, the novel coronavirus. Florian Kramer has joined us. He's a professor of microbiology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Professor Kramer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Caroline Chen with ProPublica, stand by for just a moment. We'll ask a bunch more questions and hear from a researcher who's been studying coronaviruses for 40 years. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking now about where we are in terms of the development of a potential vaccine for the novel coronavirus, because this week there was that big headline-grabbing news of a phase three trial, the launching of a phase three clinical trial with 30,000 people enrolled in that trial for a potential COVID vaccine. So I'm joined today by Caroline Chen. She is an award-winning reporter for ProPublica. She covers healthcare and the coronavirus pandemic. She's with us from New York. And joining us now is Dr. Stanley Perlman. He's a professor of microbiology, immunology, and pediatrics at the University of Iowa. He has studied coronaviruses for nearly 40 years. Dr. Perlman, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you and good morning.
So let me just ask you, first of all, fact check me. We do not yet actually have, for any of the known coronaviruses, a vaccine. Is that correct? So if this one works, or if any of these current vaccines that are in development works, they would be the first for a coronavirus.
That is correct. We've tested three coronaviruses against the last major human coronavirus, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus. So three trials, phase one trials, were completed and they were published, but we don't have anything on the market. Certainly for animal coronaviruses, we do have markets, but we do have vaccines, but that's a different story.
Oh, for coronaviruses that stay within animals you're talking about?
Yes, sorry.
Okay.
Ones for pigs or cats or whatever.
Understood. Okay. So in terms of humans, this would be a first. Now, so you have been studying coronaviruses for almost four decades, Dr. Perlman. What do you make of the fact that we have come to this point so quickly, a phase three trial within, 6 months or so of the beginning of vaccine development?
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, I think it's pretty remarkable. As was mentioned earlier by Carolyn, everything has been done really quickly. There, of course, are several issues that can't be addressed when things are done so quickly. But given the urgency of the situation, there's been a the kind of balance between making sure we answer as many questions as we can quickly and safely against the need for having it as soon as we can.
Okay. So what is it about the state of the science around coronaviruses that's allowed us to go, I keep saying us, but allowed researchers and scientists to move so quickly now?
Well, I think part of it is we know from the previous human coronavirus infections, we know a little bit about what the immune response is. We don't really know what a protective immune response is fully, but we understand the parts of the immune response that are developed. We know the viruses, we know that they're capable of mutation, but they don't do antigenic drift or changing every year like the influenza virus does. So we know, we've learned a lot about how the virus actually functions in people and in experimental animals that informs our understanding of how to make a vaccine. So that, I think that's been very helpful.
Mm. And can you talk a little bit about in the Moderna NIH case, the vaccine under development is an mRNA vaccine, if I have that right. What can you tell us what that means?
Well, this means that it's the genetic coding of a cell is DNA, and then it's transferred to RNA. Many viruses, like the COVID-19 virus, are actually RNA viruses. So if a vaccine is made in which you inject the RNA, and it wouldn't be the COVID-19 RNA, it would be part of it. If you inject it into a cell under the right circumstances, the cell itself will make it into protein, and then that protein is presented by the cell. And because it's a foreign protein, there's an immune response is developed. And because of the way it's presented, you get both antibodies, which has been talked about a lot on this program already, mm-hmm. and also T cell responses, which have been talked about a little, which are the second part of the immune response, which are probably just as important as antibodies in conferring a really good immune response.
Yeah.
Have we had other... Oh, yeah, Caroline, go ahead.
Yeah, I think... I just think this is really a fun technology and kind of amazing when you ask about mRNA vaccines. So I think a lot of people, when they think about vaccines, and this is, you know, kind of what is taught in, you know, middle school, high school science, is that, you know, you take a weakened virus and you give it to people and then the body learns what it looks like. mRNA vaccines are kind of a new technology where instead of giving the actual, you know, weakened virus or even a little piece of the virus, you're giving the body a tiny little bit of genetic code. I kind of like describe it like a recipe, which gives your body the instructions for making a little piece of virus. In this case, it's a spike protein, you know, that I'm sure everybody by now has seen many, many pictures of the coronavirus. So the Moderna vaccine gives a little piece of genetic code that just gives the instructions for making that little piece that sticks out of the coronavirus, just that little spike protein. And your body cells read that recipe and make the spike protein and kind of show it to your own immune system. And the reason why Moderna and Pfizer are kind of at the front of the line right now is because it's just a lot faster to make vaccines that are based on mRNA. So
I
that's,
see.
That's how
okay.
mRNA
Interesting.
Vaccine works.
Yeah. Okay. And so thank you for mentioning Pfizer as well, because we should remind ourselves that obviously the Moderna trial isn't it's not the only effort, right? I mean, there are lots of different groups trying to develop a vaccine. So are other processes further along down the line? I mean, could we end up actually, Caroline, with several potential vaccines for coronavirus?
Oh, definitely. And I actually think that the word race is a bit of a misnomer. I mean, obviously, all scientists, researchers, manufacturers are all racing. They're trying to move as quickly as possible. But it isn't like there's going to be one winner at the end of the day. And this is because we basically want vaccine for everyone across the globe. And Moderna is not going to be able to manufacture probably enough vaccine for the entire globe. So I expect there to be ultimately many vaccines that get approved by many manufacturers. And this is important and good because a lot of these vaccines need different treatments. Like some of them need cold storage, some of them need cold shipping. You know, different countries and different communities may have different needs. So I think it's good that many of them are going into trial. You know, we don't know that they're all going to be successful. We haven't talked about this on the show so far. Moderna and I believe Pfizer's are two shots. Moderna's is spaced a month apart. So that may not be as convenient for some people. I think some of those that are coming later on into trial are just one shot. So I think having variety is good. And I ultimately expect and hope that there will be more than one approved coronavirus vaccine.
And Dr. Perlman, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think that I tend to agree with that answer. I think one of the things to consider, and we haven't really sorted this out yet, is if the vaccines are not equivalent, if they are not equally useful, if they don't equally induce a protective immune response, if they induce different kinds of immune responses, how are we going to decide who should get what vaccine? And if you've gotten the first shot of a vaccine that's not so good, do you need to get a second shot of the same vaccine? Can you get one for a different kind of vaccine? There's a lot of issues with having multiple vaccines on the market that need to be sorted out and may contribute to both protection in the wider community and also vaccine acceptance, because it may make things rather confusing for people trying to figure out what to do as we move forward.
Okay, so regarding vaccine acceptance, we heard from an On Point listener about this. This is Cindy from Mosinee, Wisconsin.
I will not be taking the vaccine when they do come out with it. I've been through chemo. I have emphysema. I just don't believe that I should have to take a vaccine. Anyone should force me to take a vaccine. I believe in the herd immunity, and I have not been wearing a mask unless I have to.
That's Cindy from Wisconsin. Dr. Perlman, she said a lot there, but I was wondering what you would tell Cindy. What would you advise her?
Yeah, so when I used to see pediatric patients, I periodically talk to parents who didn't want their children to get vaccines, and they used a similar argument. They said, well, there's going to be herd immunity, so I don't need to get vaccinated. I shouldn't get vaccinated. In Cindy's case, she also has had cancer, and she's had other medical issues. So how well she would respond to the vaccine is a question. One of the issues, though, if you're counting on herd immunity, but you're not counting on being part of that herd, then that's an ethical problem for the community. And also, she is somebody who is likely to be at higher risk of getting more severe disease. So I hope that as we roll out vaccines, we have enough evidence to show that the vaccines work and they're safe, and we've made a good prioritization of who should get them first. And there will be things that will win over people who are skeptical about a vaccine that's being developed so quickly, in addition to people who intrinsically are worried about vaccines, the 10 or 20% of the U.S. population that's worried to begin with.
You know, Caroline, we've got this follow-up comment from someone calling themselves Sally Maria Renata online. And Sally Maria says, if you are facing a population that won't wear masks, aren't they the ones who might also not want to get vaccinated? So what will that mean for controlling the disease here?
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody's been focused on getting a working vaccine. And actually, my biggest concern is what comes after that, because there's so many more steps that come after that. And as we mentioned right at the very start of the show, you know, come fall, even if we have good data from the first of these trials, we're not going to have immediately enough vaccine for, you know, the entirety of the U.S. or the globe. Like, there's going to need to be a massive, like, prioritization and distribution scheme. And, like, having that be well-run and I think there's going to be so much need for good communication with the public. First of all, you know, how effective this vaccine is. If it's not, you know, 100% effective, you know, setting expectations for, you know, what it means to the degree of effectiveness it is. You know, if there is, are any side effects from this vaccine, like explaining to people, like what they should expect from it, and then explaining how it's going to be prioritized. Like, I don't want there to be, again, states having to, you know, compete against each other to get a limited stock of vaccine. Like, this needs to be really well organized, to then also, convey to people why they need to get the vaccine if they're in a high risk group, which is prioritized, and then making sure that people who need it have access to it. So, like, all of these things are going to have to work really well in concert together for us. I am anxious about this, frankly, let alone talking about what you just pointed to, which is the people who are going to potentially not want to get vaccine. And that's why I keep saying that, like, this is something where I think the pressures on for us to both get it right and not get it wrong, you know, because I think if there are large missteps in any of this process of distributing or manufacturing or communication, that there, unfortunately, are a lot of people who are very either concerned all the way up to, like, vociferously anti-vax, and there can be harm done to an other vaccination efforts out there that are, you know, beyond just the coronavirus vaccine. So there's a lot at stake here.
Yeah. Well, so I just want to step back a little bit from vaccines for one second, because there's also the question of where are we regarding treatment for people who are suffering from COVID. So, for example, President Trump, he was on Fox News last Wednesday, and he said he preferred therapeutics over vaccines in the short run.
I think we can knock it out before it disappears. That's what I want. And if I had my choice of vaccines or therapeutics, give me therapeutics every time, because I'd love to walk into a hospital and give everybody something and they start walking out in 2 days. That's what I'd like. Vaccine is very good longer term, but give me therapeutics, and we're doing really good work therapeutically.
This is the president last week on Fox News. Dr. Perlman, do we have better therapeutics now for the novel coronavirus?
Yeah, so I think that we're getting a little bit along that pathway. And I tend to agree with the president. If we had a really great set of therapeutics, and so people could walk in with mild disease and be treated and be protected against developing severe disease, that would be great. But we're not there yet, because the two therapies that are worth mentioning, there's a drug called remdesivir, which is directly against the virus. It's been shown against the virus itself, so it stops the virus from growing. It probably works best if it's given very early in the infection, and most of the time we don't give it that early. So in studies, it's been shown to have some effects, but they haven't been overwhelming. The other drug that we have is when people get really sick. There's a very common drug called steroids, that are corticosteroids that has been used for many infections over the years. This seems to have some efficacy, but from previous coronavirus infections, we have to be careful, because in some of those previous ones, like the SARS epidemic, they actually were associated with worse outcomes. So we're not there in having drugs that we can give to everybody walking into the hospital. It's certainly one of the things I'd love to have. If we had a marker for who's going to get severe disease and then give those people these therapies, we may go a long way to preventing the pneumonias, hospitalizations, and ICU care that's a huge part of this problem.
We've just got about 30 seconds left to go, Dr. Perlman. I wonder if you could tell me, if there's one thing that you really want people to know and understand so that they can better understand the headlines that are hitting them about vaccine development, what would it be?
Well, I think it would be, I would want people to understand that the goal of the vaccine is really twofold in my mind. You want to prevent people from getting severe pneumonia, but you also want to prevent transmission. So there's two parts. We want to prevent the amount of shedding that people have. And then, of course, I want people to be really thinking about what the vaccine will do for the whole community.
Well, Dr. Stanley Perlman, professor of microbiology, immunology, and pediatrics at the University of Iowa, thank you so much for joining us again. And Caroline Chen, healthcare reporter for ProPublica, thank you as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.